Welcome to RAQA Today, the podcast that puts the fun back in quality, compliance, and regulatory affairs. Here's your host, Michelle Lott.
So we're going to go through a couple of eSTAR basics for those of you that have not worked in it before. The eSTAR is a dynamic PDF that guides applicants through the process of preparing a comprehensive medical device submission, and it covers several different types of submissions now. It is nice because it's highly automated by the way you answer questions. It's got content and structure that's complementary to the CDRH to their internal review template, so the two work together. It integrates multiple resources like guidance documents and databases, and it has guided construction instructions for each section. And then the best part, it gives you a thumbs up or a green checkbox when you have everything complete and completed correctly. It does require unique software. You have to, or not necessarily unique, but specific software and operating systems. You have to have Acrobat Pro or the latest version of Acrobat Pro, Windows versions, and Foxit. So the advantages for FDA is to enable more efficient and consistent reviews with the goal that this productivity will allow for the evaluation of applications for devices that pose the highest potential risk for patients. And importantly, it fulfills a MDUFA, or the Medical Device User Fees Act, commitment to streamline pre-market notifications so that patients are ensured of more timely access to safe, effective, and high-quality devices. So when do you need to start paying attention to this? Well, actually, back in October 1st of 2023, eSTAR became mandatory for all 510K submissions. It is also available for pre-submissions, de novos, and PMAs, but these are still voluntary content until further notice. So why do you need to pay attention? Because effective of February 4th, 2024, only the version 5 of the template will be available for you to download and work in. And there were some major revisions between revision 4 and revision 5 that you need to know about and be prepared for. So one interesting thing is that even though if you check the FDA website and it tells you, you know, version 5 and it only has one available for you to download, when you downloaded it, you might actually have a minor revision. Like at the time that I took this screenshot, it was 5.1 was actually active. So don't just check before you download. Don't just check that the version that you have on your local computer is version 5. Actually download it and then double check that it doesn't have any minor revisions in it or available. So version 5 was released in December 6th of 2023, again, after that October 1st full implementation date. And the biggest changes were in the areas of cybersecurity, biocompatibility, and clinical investigation. And we'll get into those a little bit more depth shortly. Another important thing about eSTAR is how it changed the way that FDA reviews documentation. Prior to eSTAR, this was more of a pull of documentation by the FDA out of manufacturers. There were, you know, not only the RTA or refuse to accept process, but, you know, there was the substantive and the interactive and substantive interactions where the FDA would request additional information or changes from the manufacturer. With eSTAR, the goal is to move that to a little bit more of a push method of collecting information by the FDA from the manufacturer. So the eSTAR template is supposed to prompt manufacturers to turn in more complete and more accurate submissions from the get-go. So the interactive review format. So this is a form that kind of builds itself in terms of content that's available to you so that you get the right content for the type of submission you're doing. So if you select the pre-market notification bubble or icon, it is going to open up different options for you. So then you can select the type of applications, and then you can see like PMA functionality was actually added in that version 5 on December 6th. And if you were to select de novo or PMAs, you would get a whole different set of content available in the form. So recommendations for streamlining your attachments to eStar. And these are just what I have found to be good practices and kind of facilitate the order and organization is to consider combining your attachments so that there's only one attachment is provided in each question to eStar. And that's because pagination can be a big deal. And we'll see why I'm going to say that in a minute here. So include bookmarks or tables of contents within those attachments. And then use smart naming conventions to facilitate finding the attachments. We recommend sequential numbering the title that matches the attachment description in the eStar. And one interesting thing about eStar is that no longer are you bound to just PDFs, but you can have PDFs, Word documents, Excel documents, MP3s, MP4s. You can check the FDA website for a full list of the applicable attachments. But one thing they do not accept is zip files. And this is for a variety of reasons, including their bug scanner softwares. This means that you're gonna have no more random miscellaneous files or attachment folders at the end of your 510K PDFs. Make sure that you review all questions carefully. Anything that you see in a yellow header text box could potentially be public facing. So make sure that you do not put anything that you consider proprietary in a text box for yellow headers. Put it all in attachments if you have the proprietary information. Because again, these could be for public access potentially, depending on how you answer other questions in the eStar. So if we look at how eStar compares to a normal 510K, additional traceability information from the related guidance documents is used, and each section in the template has a section where you can fill in the guidance documents that correspond with that section or that bit of information that you're attaching. This is unique because the former just methodology of doing 510Ks, it was up to you to reference a guidance document. If you used it, there wasn't necessarily anything to prompt you to put it in for the FDA's consideration of the data that you're going to turn in. So also compared to a normal 510K, you know, you need to make sure that you attach in the eStar full versions of other submissions you've had with the agency, and not just the full text that you turned in and attachments, but also the full communication or interactions that you had back and forth with the agency. And so you can see that if you start having to attach your non-substantial equivalent or your withdrawals, this file could get quite large, and file size is going to be important. The requirement in the eStar template for several sections, including labeling, has been to be very specific with the attachment name and number and the page numbers where the critical info can be found in that attachment. And so this is where, you know, when I recommended combining attachments into a single attachment can be helpful when you're having to reference page numbers across maybe many different reports or sections, if they're all in one attachment with bookmarks, and the pagination can be a little bit easier to specify. So some sections are totally different in the eSTAR versus the normal 510K. There is no longer a submission cover sheet or an indications for use form. The eSTAR form itself actually kind of builds these things rather than you having to create them separately and put them in as an attachment. Also, the FDA has cleaned up the FDA, the 510K contents to a level in that things like the class 3 summary statement are no longer included because you don't need those unless you're using the PMA version of it. And then the financial disclosure, that's also not included anymore. You do still have to attach those, but they're just it's not like a whole separate section. This is pretty cool. The decision summary reports are not required sections, and that is because the eSTAR template will build them and generate them for you. So if we look at a strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats, and analysis for the eSTAR program, we'll kind of walk through each of these areas and talk about how this is going to impact your use of the eSTAR and for the version 5.0. So some of the strengths is that there's no longer a refuse to accept review due to the automatic verification of the eSTAR template itself. So in theory, this means that it could lead to faster substantive interaction, but some people have said, and at times I have seen no difference. I've even seen one that took 2 weeks, so it was really no faster than the RTA process. And that's because even though there is no RTA process anymore, there is still a technical review that the submission goes through. So strengths include that the eSTAR aligns with the FDA internal review templates. So your documentation is supposed to populate their review a little bit more succinctly and make the process more efficient for them. It also integrates guidance document expectations. We'll look at some examples of that in a second. That's really helpful. It also has error messages that pop up based on how you answer the questions. So if you answer questions that your device has like wireless technology, but you said no to the software question, then it's going to ask you, wait a second, something's not adding up here about how you're describing your product to us in these drop-down menus. And then there's blue question marks that have really helpful text and context for the consideration of what does this question really mean and if you're answering it correctly or not. So there is an option to automate the 510K summary section if you check yes or no. You can still do it manually, which is how I still approach this. But the reason why I said that it's important before about those yellow header sections and about what is proprietary and what is not is that the eSTAR takes the information that you enter as the response to those yellow highlighted areas and puts those as part of the auto-generated summary, unless you select that no for that answer to that question. So again, if you put proprietary in those text box, it could be put in your publicly available 510K summary. But it's also handy to have it auto-generated for you. Now, this is an example of what it looks like if you had checked the answer where you wanted it to generate this summary for you so that you didn't have to do it. It's easy to tell that this is automatically generated because it's in the same format as the template. The format is more standardized in most of these text areas, but it doesn't read very cleanly and it can be a little bit clunky. And then in the technological comparison and the device descriptions, this is the areas where you may inadvertently put more information than you would typically provide to the general public in a 510K summary that you made yourself. The other reason I like to write my own 510K summaries is not only being in control of the information, but you know, most of the regulatory professionals on this call know that when you're looking for predicate devices, you are scavenging these potential predicate 510K summaries for which one's the best, which one has the most information known about it. So it's another way to control the information that your competitors have and can know about your device to be used for a predicate comparison. So it has automatic completeness verification. And so it will have a red banner or sign mark next to the verification section. And it will show you that all the sections that are remaining that are incomplete. And at the end of the submission, you want to make sure that this section has turned fully green on this bar on the side and says that there are no longer incomplete sections remaining. So you don't have to mess around with the standards forms anymore. FDA will auto populate these. Also, this is linked to the Recognized Consensus Standard database. So you can start typing, you know, the information you know, be it one of the recognition numbers or the standards number or the standards name, and it will start helping you populate the rest of these. And then it will auto populate the declaration of conformity to that standard, depending on if you indicate that you're going to use the standard for a DFC purpose or if you're going to use it for general use. It also is linked to the guidance document database, and it will generate the applicable guidance documents linked to your product code. So for instance, we put in that we had a FRN infusion pump, and it pulled up this guidance document that's linked to infusion pumps. Everybody in industry that's not regulatory, they keep saying, oh, the guidance documents, those are voluntary. Well, as you're going to see from this and some changes in the 5.0 version, yeah, they're voluntary, but now the FDA expects you to acknowledge them within the submission, and they are going to prompt you and draw out and ask you specific questions about what about this guidance document? How did you comply, or what did you do? How was it better? But just know that there are still draft guidance documents out there. Those are still totally voluntary because they're obviously not finalized, but they do reflect FDA's current thinking on things that you might just need to at least be aware that those are questions you could get from a reviewer in your submission. So the template continues to improve. So in version 5.0, one of the big improvements that was made was the biocompatibility section. Before, in the older versions, you had to click through each section and answer a question about it, even if it was not applicable. And it was just a very tedious process. Well, now you don't have to click through. You just click through the ones you did, and then you attach them. You can do one attachment or many attachments, whatever is the most convenient for the way your biocompatibility data and reports are arranged in the labs that they came from. So this was also interesting, is in the help text, the FDA is based off of the answers you give, they will prompt you, if you were to check the help text, about their particular interpretation for your answer. Now, this is really meaningful because maybe you didn't contact your gas or didn't classify your gas pathway as externally communicating with contact to tissue bone and didn't. Maybe you classified it with a different means of contact. Well, it's a bad time to find out about it, but better than, you know, getting a submission put on hold and potentially not being able to make the whole timeline with testing that you might have to do based on how FDA is interpreting guidance and recognized consensus standards in these areas. So there for cybersecurity, that was the next biggest area that was changed and updated. And this went from maybe a quarter of a page of questions about cybersecurity to very nearly a full page before you even answer any questions. And they've gotten very risk specific and very life cycle to the device specific. So make sure they're asking for risk in several different levels of the product development. And so make sure that you're answering the questions about the right set of your risk management process. Again, they've gotten to a very high level of detail and they had to have an emphasis, just like we saw in labels, to pointing to specific attachment names, numbers, and page numbers in which that you can find the requested information. And that even go into detail about all of the points of information that they want to know, where did these things occur? Where did you discuss them in your cybersecurity documentation? And they're asking this regardless of the risk level of your device in terms of software as well. So what does this mean? Well, it means that FDA is not playing Where's Waldo with your 510K anymore. I believe in subsequent revisions of the eSTAR template, we are going to see more and more sections where the FDA says, tell me exactly not only what attachment to look in, but what page on it to look. So the timing of when you build out your eSTAR versus your attachments, and then if you have to make changes to attachments, can get quite tricky as you're trying to build and answer these questions about specifically where is something within your eSTAR package. So secrets to success for your cybersecurity, you know, it's all about the details. Make sure that you are reading the text, so that the help text, so that you know the FDA's intent and interpretations about what they expect out of the documentation that you use to answer these questions. And the help text is going to point you to the right section. Not just the specific guidance document, but the specific sections within the guidance document to look for how you should be answering that question. You know, just before eSTAR went live in October of 2023, the FDA released the cybersecurity guidance document for the expectations in pre-market submissions. And almost all of these go one-to-one for what FDA wants to see in the cybersecurity section of eSTAR. This is also very handy, is that there are cross-section change reminders. So if you change the answer to a question, you will get a pop-up to ask about, did you mean to change this? Or, hey, if you said no here, we are not going to make available to you other sections of the template. So therefore you might, you either might miss or have too many sections related to how you answer the device or questions, but the pop-ups now will help you double check those. Clinical data was also something that was a big update to the eSTAR, particularly for 510Ks, because it got more detailed and they added more help text around what they expect for clinical data in 510Ks. But particularly in the PMAs and de novos, they got much more extensive about the questions they ask and how they ensure compliance with CFR 812. So as for the weaknesses, You need to be aware of the file size. So the processing of your submission might be delayed. If the whole eSTAR PDF and all of its attachments as a whole exceed 4 gigabytes in size, or 1 gigabyte per any one file type. And that is the FDA's bug scanning software kind of freaks out a little bit if they're larger than that. Your file version, so make sure you're using that current version of the eSTAR template for your required content. And while the file versioning does have an export and import version, it will only export and then re-import any text that you've entered in those text box. And then if you get caught, but it will not export or import the attachments. You have to start over with your attachments. So you have to make sure, you know, always be checking your most updated versions of the applications for the PDF creation and your JavaScript that you're using. There are known bugs, particularly in Adobe Acrobat Pro, that the FDA is working with to sort out. So just be aware of that as those programs change and eSTAR gets updated, that you're working across the platforms that are compatible. More weaknesses. This is a process that is still being worked out. I make a joke that FDA kind of broke its own internet, because their expectation was that when you used eSTAR, that you would also use the customer collaboration portal to upload your submission. But there are known issues with the customer collaboration portal being compatible with certain manufacturers' eSTARs. And in those cases, you have to be prepared to mail your version in the kind of the old fashioned way on the thumb drives. So there are also complications with the signatures. There are several sections of the 510K, like truthful and accuracy, that needs to be assigned by the official correspondent, while, you know, consultants or can sign other sections. So there are workarounds and digital signatures, and also having a wet signature that is signed, scanned, and then you upload the scan of the signature or the signed attachment to the appropriate section of the eSTAR. And then the official correspondent's responsible for finalizing all these signatures. In practice, file collaboration is going to have to occur outside of the eSTAR template, because eSTAR does not track changes. The file sharing of the eSTAR template can be difficult because it is so big. It does not play well often with shared cloud storage. And then if you rely on iterative editing, or editing with reviewers or multiple people authoring a 510K, like people work with consultants, you have to be mindful. You won't be able to see what other people added or edited or changed by using the eSTAR template. Another challenge is that makes reviewing and editing and sharing files difficult and to know what changed, is that there's limited space for viewing, and so scrolling's required. As you can see, you get like maybe 3 to 4 lines of visible text, and then you just have to scroll down until you've read all the text in the box. And for, you know, lengthy descriptions or answers, this can get really tedious, because you're reading very technically and very focused, but you can only read 4 lines at a time. So you'll be kind of going back and forth trying to review this if you're doing it inside. So what we do is we collaborate in the good old-fashioned Word templates for each section. Then as a team, as everybody okays it, then we will copy it over into the eSTAR. Opportunities for the eSTAR platform include global harmonization initiatives They have already had a pilot with Health Canada, and they're kind of working out the details of how that's going to ultimately be implemented. And they're exploring standardization with other countries in this process. I talked to somebody from the FDA recently, and they mentioned, you know, Brazil and the MDSAP countries are likely to be next in terms of harmonization. But it's still kind of confusing. What does it look like beyond eSTAR? Because there are so many fundamental things in eSTAR that are different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So it's kind of like, how much efficiency is this really going to facilitate? They are going to continue to expand to other submission types. So they've already released de novo, pre-submissions, and PMAs. Again, those are voluntary. They're not mandatory, but you can anticipate that being mandatory for these types of submissions is imminent. And then there are other pre-submission, or other Q submission types coming, including, I think, INDs is the next big one on their list. Threats. The template crashes. This happens often. It is a fairly unstable and finicky template in that way. So someone in your organization made a change and you didn't catch it, and therefore now there's a disconnect in your submission, or maybe it wasn't correct. Because the template crashes and it takes forever when you make a change, when you upload a document, you know, make attachments, all of those things take a long time to process when you're looking across the length of time, the amount of answers you have to give, and the amount of attachments that you have to upload. Is that you've got too much time wasted in front of your computer. And then, you know, what if you've been working in, say, your template revision changes, and you need to import and re-export, or export and import your data. So, and then because of all these things, the biggest threat may be mostly to your mental health in this process, either wasting your time or you didn't save early and often and your template crashed and you lost your data. So in summary, you know, I think the strengths far outweigh the weaknesses and the opportunities and the threats. These are just things you need to be mindful of so that you can minimize them and make them as efficient for you and your organization as possible.